Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And good day to everybody. Glad to have you aboard for another edition of Midrats. And if you are with us live, I'd like to extend the invitation for you to scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That is where you will find the chat room. And that is the perfect place to join in with some of the usual suspects during the course of the show. If you have some observations you'd like to share, or if there are some questions you would like for us to direct to our guests during the course of the next hour, that's a great place to go. We'll monitor it during the course of the show, and we'll try to bring in your thoughts and observations into the conversation for the next hour. And if you've got some stuff you got to take care of and you got to run off, or if your schedule makes it a little difficult for you to catch us live, you can always take a shortcut and go over to iTunes, Spreaker, Spotify, whatever podcast aggregator you use, and find Midrats and subscribe. It's free, and that way we'll be waiting for you to join you for your commute or any other time you've got some white space in your schedule. And hopping on today's schedule, today's show, it's going to be a good one, because when I read this article, a lot of it really hit home. But what really hit home to me is the fact that we've got a fleet lieutenant who's thinking this way and is looking at some ideas that we can use going forward. And when you look at everything that you've read and we've talked about here, other places in the media or the chatterati space, everybody's been looking at the challenge that we are facing with the increasing size and capability of the Chinese fleet on the other side of the Pacific. And as we look at how to address that, the past always has ideas, clues, lessons, and sometimes frameworks and templates that you can modernize, bring up to date, and you don't have to reinvent the wheel a lot of times when the spare parts are already there. And that's what we're going to look at today, is back the last time the U.S. Navy faced significant challenges on the high seas, and we had to make a case to not only ourselves, but to the American people and their elected representatives to give the Navy the resources it need to grow, so if the call came, we would be able to execute as the people would expect. So we're going to look at some of the lessons that we can take from that relatively successful intellectual, political, and struggle to grow our Navy back when I was just a midshipman and Eagle One, I think, was approaching 04 maybe. could be. But our guest today, he recently wrote an article in Naval History Magazine a few months ago titled Lessons from the 600-Ship Navy, and he'll be with us for the full hour. That's Lieutenant Joseph Sims, United States Navy. Lieutenant Sims is a surface warfare officer and a 2018 graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy, where he majored in history, and he's presently serving as the main propulsion assistant aboard the USS Antietam. And Joseph, he is with us here as an individual. His comments and opinions may or may not represent that of the United States Navy or any other organization he may be associated with. Joseph, welcome to Midrats.
Well, good evening, Commander Sal. It's great to be on the show. I'm excited to be on and discuss the lessons from the 1980s and some of the enduring tenets that we can take from that period.
And it's interesting when you sent me your brief bio and I looked at it, I kind of took a deep sigh. I said, Lord Almighty, this lieutenant got his commission a solid 3 decades after I got mine. But in the continuity that we have in the naval profession, and you're a history major, so I don't need to explain this to you, but understanding history, it gives you at least an intellectual habit when you are facing something new, is to take a moment and pause and go, okay, Have other people gone through similar challenges before? And in hindsight, which is a great gift to have, you know, what are some of the things we can take away from that? And so here you are, you're, you know, a little over 4 years past commissioning date, and I don't think there's any other cohort than your cohort that's going to have to face the challenge that older generations now had the luxury of being able to sit and talk about. And that's going to be the period from 2025 to 2040 when you look at the projections, it's no longer a theoretical challenge on the other side of the Pacific. If not already today, it's a very real challenge. And so it's going to take a lot of good thinking and good decisions in order to allow you and in your cohort to be able to move forward in the next couple of decades and to do kind of what we talked about in the intro, which is answer the bell if it comes. So what was it that brought you to that place and time back in the – you outlined pretty well where the intellectual efforts actually started at the end of the 1970s, but kind of hit its high mark at the publication of the 1986 Maritime Strategy. But what brought you to look back at that point and to look for what we might want to remember about it as we face the challenge today?
Well, Sal, I found myself with a little extra time in Newport, Rhode Island, as I was going through ADOC and the Prospective Engineering Officer course after my first division officer tour on USS Lassen. And on the Lassen, we were in Fifth Fleet during the 2019-2020 period after they had after the United States had taken out Soleimani and the tensions were increased, and there was significant we had dual carrier operations for a brief moment in time, and then going back to Rhode Island. And then you just see on the walls the pictures of the ship of these fleet exercises, and then I was reading Oceans Ventured by Admiral Lehman, and it was just inspirational. Just the strategic vision and the execution of that time period, and then the impact that it ultimately had, and it seemed fitting since there was a lot of cynicism around the fleet a little bit, that the fleet had, you know, and a lot of it pointing at true ideas that sometimes had been spread too thin, and that there with the surface fleet had been spread too thin, which is true, which has been true in many respects. But I think we have to move forward in a concrete direction. And I think the 80s in a positive direction, and I think the buildup from the 80s provides that framework in many ways.
Well, one of the things I liked in your article was that you did comment on the fact that, and I guess historically, you cited the people who said this initially, we can't basically tech our way into a fix of not having enough ships. You kind of want to discuss that and what your take is on that?
I think so. Admiral Hayward basically said there's no free lunch in the maritime superiority business. That was something that in his strategy from document from the late 1970s that I thought was very insightful. That he's like, and he pointed at maritime superiority, and that there's something in the number of ships that need to be necessary in order to provide the depth to execute the high-end exercises necessary for great power competition. And so I think there's the temptation to think that, you know, that there will be revolutionary offsetting technology that will come, and that there won't be the need to do this, but just the hard work of just executing large-scale exercises, preparing for the high-end fight, if there might. And obviously, there's a lot of new technologies that are coming that have the potential to really change warfare. But that's not going to happen until it happens, and there's no guarantee that it will ever happen. And so until then, we have the ships that we have, and we have to learn how to employ them as proficiently as possible and as tactically lethally as possible. And so that's, I think that, and that was one of the points in the 1980s is they worked with what they had and made a set realistic goals that could be achieved.
Yeah, I thought that was a very good point, and it comes in right in the middle of your article, and it's really timely, because when people look at the defense buildup, a lot of people will point at, well, you know, they brought the battleships back. Yeah, that's the high-profile thing, but they also did a lot, for instance, really built a whole bunch of Oliver Hazard Perry-class frigates, which are no longer in the U.S. Navy, but they serve very well with some of our allied and aligned nations' Navy to this day. They also built the Spruance-class destroyer with a lot of white space for weapons to be named later. It's like these things weren't quite mature, and you know, we can't force it, but we know it'll probably come down the road, so we'll leave the capability there. I think there was a lot of grumbling about the Spruances when they were first commissioned because of that white space, but I think when they really came to fruition back when we got the VLS cells on them, they really proved their worth. And there's a lot of inside the lifelines intellectual churn that you outline in your article that's required to get there. And part of that seduction that about technology, you know, we're still going to go through, and they went through at that time there. But the mindset of the leadership in the Navy, there was a lot of continuity there. Sometimes, without mentioning any names, you can get a little whipsawed going from one CNO to another administration, inside and out. But you outlined there that with the right leaders and the right ideas in place in discussing, that eventually you can get some leverage. For instance, talk for a bit for the 70, what you found out about the period of the late 1970s, where, you know, one of the quotes from your article was, quote, "There was very little agreement within the government over the Navy's principal missions and how to structure the fleet to meet them." And you had a group of senior naval officers such as Admiral Holloway, Admiral Hayward, Admiral Lyons, who advocated at the tail end of the Carter administration. In many ways, you could say, you know, waiting for a more fertile ground when the Reagan administration came in, that they already had done the intellectual work and had built the network to support it, such that when that opportunity did present themselves, they were able to move forward to build that naval force structure. Talk a little bit about those three and perhaps some other ones that really set the foundation at the end of the 1970s for what we saw for the first, you know, especially two-thirds of the 1980s.
I think it really struck me that it was very much internal to the Navy. A lot of this, the strategy and getting all of the blueprints ready, that with the Sea Plan 2000 that Admiral Holloway first initiated at the Naval War College, and so the templates were in place, so that when there was the political will, the Navy had a concrete plan on the table that was feasible and worthy of funding. And I was looking at a recent article by former Secretary Lehman and Proceedings recently. I think it was published last January. And he mentioned that same thing, is that he funded existing institutions within the Navy that had called for this buildup. And so people like Admiral Lyons had put in the operational strategies and to carry out these high north exercises and build up the fleet in a positive direction, to as opposed to the previous where before the the Navy had a secondary role and during the during a potential war with the Cold War, potential war with the Soviet Union. And so I think it's I think that was something significant, is that people Seaplan 2000 Bing West, it was a group of naval officers, 04s, 05s, 06s as well, within that Seaplan 2000s that really came up with a lot of the blueprints to execute this 600 ship buildup.
Well, one of the, I don't know if you looked into it, but I mean, one of the questions is, back in those days, we had a number of naval shipyards, many of which were closed due to BRAC or because of allegedly they were higher cost than commercial shipyards. Did you look at that at all in context of how we got, could develop back to a 600 ship Navy if we don't have the shipbuilding capacity we might have had in the 80s?
I think that's an extremely important piece of moving forward, is getting that shipbuilding capacity back. I know there's been a lot written about that in proceedings lately. And so that's going to be a central plank of getting the fleet back up in numbers. But I haven't looked into that specifically.
One of the things that I find a little bit of overlap is, you know, like I said, I was just a midshipman when all this was coming to a peak in the mid to late 80s. But I remember the arguments, because I remember when I was, I think, a second class midshipman, they handed everybody a copy of the Maritime Strategy. I still have it in my library. I'll pull it out now and then, say, yeah, this is how it's done. But there was a certain rhyme today when people talk about the Taiwan Straits, what we can do if we need to or are asked to do about Taiwan, the South China Sea. There's a lot of difference, but there's also a lot of rhyming about that in the Chinese mindset and the High North in the Soviet mindset back in the 1980s. And the efforts that we were able to make in a rather short period of time, you look at from the late 70s to the mid 80s, you cover in your articles that subsequent members of the Soviet General Staff attested that that was a major factor in the deliberations and loss of confidence of the Soviet government that led to its collapse. And, you know, my co-host could probably talk to this as well, which is a pretty amazing statement when you consider the state of our Navy after the U.S. withdrawal, and then a few years later, the fall of South Vietnam, that we could turn around and have that much of an impact in such a short time on the Soviets. And part of that, and I wanted to, as somebody who has spent some time in these waters recently, and you know the fleet today better than anything else, in conjunction with what allies we have in the Pacific, and I think there's been a significant change in the last couple, 3 years, especially among the Japanese and to a lesser extent the South Koreans. But back in 1985, there was Ocean Safari 85, where the U.S. With our allies, the Coast Guard and the Air Force, was off the East Coast and then went all the way across the Atlantic, went north of England, east of Iceland, and ended up in the Norwegian Sea with 155 ships and 280 fixed wings aircraft and helicopters. And they actually had the Soviet Navy come out to play some with training you just can't script any better. But talk for a little bit about what that would look like in a modern context if something similar was to be done somewhere between Honshu and the Philippines sometime in the next few years.
I think that's the million-dollar question, is exactly what type of exercises to execute to train for this conflict. And I think Admiral Swift had some good ideas about that, integrating carrier strike groups. I think the specifics, I don't have all the answers for the specifics of that, but I think we need to it needs to be something that is prioritized, and I think 7th Fleet, I think we all, I think that's, I think the Navy knows that that's the big question, and that's what we're working towards. But I think the details of that are still, I don't have the details to that.
Well, one of the other interesting aspects of where we're going, I mean, we were, I swear, just a couple of years ago, we were talking about trying to get to 355 ships. And again, we seem to be keen on building large ships. And despite all the warnings of people who have wargamed any number of scenarios in which if you lose, I mean, If you lose a DDG, you've lost more than just one capability. You've lost a bunch of capability. Is there an argument for having not spending money on, you know, a new DDGX and a CGX and all that, but on many smaller ships, even smaller than, you know, I guess they're corvette size or smaller, rather than you know, than the new frigates that are coming down the line? Is there an argument for that on the basis of what you've read historically?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at the uses of the Navy in the lower end conflicts, escort services through the Strait of Hormuz or during a time of war, or potentially if for a scenario in the Pacific, some type of blockade, if we were to blockade the various choke points, if there were a war with China, I think the lower, more attritable, expendable combatants would definitely would be something that we would want to have would want to have in the fleet. And that, I think, I know, Captain Hendricks has written about that. And I think a lot of what he has written has, makes a lot of sense. And I think the Navy knows that. I think it's just, kind of recovering from the LCS. And, I think there's a lot of energy and enthusiasm behind the new frigate, the frigates coming out.
Yeah. Looking at, you know, your experience on the fleet, you know, when the USS Lassen, I believe, is it's a, what, 21-year-old ship now. You know, it's based off the design of the Arleigh Burke. You know, I remember Hull 1, actual, when she left BIW, pulled into Portland, Maine, and back when they had the Big Blue Dry Dock down there and had her finishing out. And now you're on the Antietam, which I believe is over 30 years old, I believe maybe 35 or so. And, you know, these are ships where – they're here and they're filling the gap. We're still built. I would tease my friend Mark Vandroff now and then that we're gonna be building Arleigh Burks until I assume room temperature, because we've been building them a long time. They're still doing just fine. But previous generations failed your generation, where we didn't appreciate risk and a lot of the challenges of overestimating our ability to bring on new technology that you do outline well in your article. So we missed out not just on CGX, which never wound up cutting metal on, much less approving a final design. We have parade-friendly DDG 1000, the Zumwalt, and, of course, LCS. We're decommissioning them before the commissioning ceremonies are almost done. So we've lost a generation of warships. And so we're going into, and you rightfully mentioned, you know, the upcoming Constellation class frigates really is a too important to fail type of program. But you put on a nice little warning there about disruptive technologies and perhaps too much optimism when it comes to unmanned systems. If you had a chance, if somebody said, hey, here's an extra $7 billion of shipbuilding funds for the next 2 or 3 years, and because you and your sailors have a vested interest in where that's going, you know, what are some of those things that you see that really work on the fleet, really are best shaped to address our challenge if we wanted it being able to be deployable and usable by 2030. You know, where would Lieutenant Joseph Sims love to put $7 billion right now if he had that option?
That's a good question. I mean, I think the frigate is really the best hope right there. If we're just talking about a specific platform, and then as well as the Flight 3 DDG, I think those getting the Flight 3 DDGs out with the Spy 6 radar, I think those are, from what I've seen. Those are two viable, pretty not overly ambitious. I think there's the right amount of risk and reward, and able to deliver a concrete capability. I'd be really excited to start see the Flight 3D destroyers as well as the frigates.
And kind of a little follow-on to that, if my co-host will indulge me a bit, is you also had an interesting and very informative and really immortal quote from Admiral Holloway there, where he said, quote, I don't think this is a direct quote, this is just a paraphrase, but Admiral Holloway, about force structure planning and the importance of risk assessment, said that force structure is derived from consideration of strategy, threat, and risk. If a proper strategy is projected, the threat correctly assessed, and the risks accurately identified, uncertainty can be minimized and naval requirements can be established. And, you know, kind of what you and I have taken a shortcut on is we've talked about threat. Obviously, we're looking on the other side of the Pacific, and we've talked about risk, known systems and systems we need. But the strategy that we're all trying to work under, what type of additional work do you think could be done to better explain, outline, or to sell the naval strategy that ultimately we should be able to attach whatever we're talking about when it comes to the threat and the risk?
I think just being more concrete and relating what ships we need where, how they relate, and the U.S. Navy's overall mission of both deterring conflict and maintaining stability, as well as training to fight and win the war at sea if that occurs. I think the requirements you know to have certain destroyer in certain places around the world, as well as a carrier strike group and different fleets, the various requirements of different geographic and combatant commanders' signals, and then relating that to the overall framework of yes, China is the People's Republic of China is the primary threat, but it's not realistic to just think that we can devote everything there and not have to worry about what's going on in either Iran or Russia, and that won't take up resources as well. And so in terms of, the strategy, I think just being more specific in just how much requirements the U.S. Navy really has around the world to keep the peace. And then I think that's the key to address is that we have these ships out here, and they're not just driving around in circles. They're providing presence, which is preventing conflicts. And whenever there is a crisis, like after we killed Soleimani, or during when Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan, there's the political demand for U.S. Ships to be present so that we can negotiate from a position of strength. And I think the two things that we have to do, deterrence, sea control, power, the various missions, I think they're just, I just think there's just kind of a disconnect, and there's kind of, and a lot of that is tied with the delusion that new technologies, including the new precision-guided munitions that China has, and as well as unmanned systems, that all of these have made sea power less relevant, that the ships are, you know, sitting ducks in a war. And so I think the full capabilities of what the carrier brings and how it's defended, I don't think is that well understood outside of the Navy, perhaps. And maybe explaining that better would, and just the continuing, I think there's just a desire that the carrier has seen its last days, and that comes sometimes within the Navy as well. And so I think that's one of the ways that we could message this a little bit better.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, that we internally, our dialogue sometimes works at cross purposes to the need to explain, well, you know, those are discussions that need to be had, but it doesn't mean that we shouldn't have X number of ships, because we need that number to stop, I guess what we used to, you know, the problems we had at ships out of Yokosuka, where we're driving the ships too hard and not giving enough time to allow for the proper training of the crews. And that, I don't know, I hope that's not a current issue for you, but is there a feeling, and I, if you don't want to answer this, feel free not to, but is there a feeling among your community that we're riding these ships too hard and hanging them up wet and we're going to lose people as a result of the seeming indifference to their personal lives and schedules, because we don't have enough ships, we have to keep everybody out there for longer periods of time?
That's a tough question, but I think, to be honest, I think the Navy, I haven't seen the Navy do anything that's unsafe in the way it deploys ships and the optimum fleet response plan. I haven't seen a ship that gets underway. I haven't been on a ship. I've been the main propulsion assistant for over a year. I haven't felt that I've in any way been in a situation that's unsafe, or that the Navy, we were not ready to get underway. I felt like we've always, since I've been on board during my 9-month deployment on Lassen, and during my last patrol, I think the Navy does, I've seen from my experience that we've just gone out and done the mission, and that there's challenges that occur, and that there's the Navy is just by nature of just being at sea for long periods of time, that it's tough, and the ships are old. I think we're definitely, I think everybody recognizes that in terms of logistics support for the cruisers, especially that a lot of, and probably destroyers as well, a lot of repair parts that we, there needs to be, you know, better, more depth in the supply chain, so that there's not the need to, you know, cannibalize from other ships. And I think that's recognized, that we don't want to do that again. But that has, I'd say that's the only, just the fact that we have to sometimes can take parts from other ships. And that's been around for a while. So, I think that's not necessarily saying an example of just being rode too hard, but I think definitely getting back on a sustainable footing should be the goal. And I think a lot of that has to do with depth in the force structure, so that we can then do both high-end exercises and the routine deployments. But in my experience, I haven't been in a situation that I felt like the Navy has, that we've gotten underway in a position that we weren't ready to go underway.
And that kind of jives with other guys that I've and ladies that I've talked to recently, that, you know, after the events of the summer of 2017, while you were still in Annapolis, that there was a large effort to do what could be done better, that really started to bear fruit. It takes a couple years for these things to really bear fruit, but started to bear fruit about three or so years ago, especially. And I think people are trying to do the best they can with the ships they have. And, you know, you mentioned our friend Jerry Hendricks a while ago, and I tease him sometimes because his Fords, not Ferraris, and Influence Squadrons, it seems to be new every couple of years as more people rediscover it and really are waiting for it. And a lot of what the challenges you talk about maintaining ships is not just an old ship, but any ships has to do with yard availability period, experienced craftsmen, having more than one dry dock you can go to. And that's building that infrastructure. And for an Aegis guy like yourself, I was impressed the fact that you emphasized a couple of times that, we've talked about China a fair bit. You've mentioned, some of your experience there in the Fifth Fleet AOR, which is also a high profile. But we are a global Navy, and we've talked about exercises a few bit, and those are absolutely critical to maintain our relationships with other navies and their ability to work with us. And that takes a big size fleet. And, people call them low end combatants. You mentioned, patrol craft is one. I think the frigate often is considered that as well, corvette size. There's a whole series of small craft as well that work really well with a lot of our friends and partners that the Antietam pulls into port. That's just, that might as well be a Star Destroyer from Star Wars for some nations. It's just completely outside of their scan. But that investment in a balanced fleet gives us to do the peacetime part of the soft power competition, soft part of the great power competition. And you mentioned Rick Berger and Mackenzie Eaglin about how they summarize how competition today it doesn't eliminate or get rid of the big crisis, but there's a whole series of things that a Navy that would like to be the naval force of the world needs numbers to do. So, the 9-month deployment isn't the standard. It's the old 6-month deployment, but you've got to do what you do with the few ships that we can. Talk a bit about some of those other missions in the Navy. You could see the lower end combatants, the old high-low mix, could do, and how that would give us some capabilities and what type of positive effects that could bring the fleet.
I think a lot of the patrol craft have been very active in Fifth Fleet escorting. I think anybody that's been out to Fifth Fleet, the PCs are very, very active, and they've been worked a long time. And I think the plan is for them to be replaced by Coast Guard ships primarily. As well as there was a lot of excitement originally around the Mark VI patrol craft and the early command opportunity there. A lot of people have, read Wayne Hughes and the different ways that these smaller ships, even like missile patrol craft can be employed in a time of war. And I think especially with some of the war at sea strategies and the Pacific AOR that they could, there's a lot of utility in terms of blockading and patrolling, working with allies, as well as just in Fifth Fleet. And so I think, as well as counter-drug interdictions, when I was on last, and we did that for about 3 months, and it was exciting and a good rewarding experience, but probably not the best use of a destroyer. And so that would be another, the drug interdiction, the maritime security, the counter-piracy, all of those things that are important and kind of cementing the United States as the leader on the high seas, but they don't necessarily require a $1 billion destroyer or cruiser. As well as I think the other thing that having these patrol craft, I think they're tactically useful, but I think they're also important in giving early command opportunities to junior officers and mid-grade officers. And I think a lot of I think a lot of the job satisfaction of being a surface warfare officer comes from leading, getting to lead sailors at sea. And that would be a retention tool to get the right people to stay in, is to keeping those within the Navy.
Yeah, you're singing from a hymnal that many of us have written about and discussed for a long time. And during the height of the Somali piracy, I couldn't understand why we were not having PCs and other type smaller ships out there, or even making up some ships that, you know, taking up some stuff from offshore petroleum support ships and stuff, and manning them up the way and arming them and using those instead of having, as you said, a multi-billion-dollar destroyer, or I think even an aircraft carrier got involved in one of the Somali pirate endeavors. You know, that kind of activity is important, but we have a blue water fleet, which it's a challenge for us to take that blue water fleet into the green water or the littoral areas and without exposing it to things we don't want to be exposed to. Not that they're not capable of responding, but it just seems like a waste of assets, and wasting the assets. Plus, I know back when I was a lieutenant, I would have loved to have command of something. And some of my contemporaries got, you know, they were lucky enough to get PT boats and some other smaller ships like that. Do you think that would be, I know you just said it, but I mean, do people discuss that sort of thing? Like, it'd be great to have your own small coastal missile boat that you could run around in?
When the Mark VIs came out, the best SWOs that I knew applied for the early command program on my last ship and on this ship, and people I knew from the academy, those the people that I would want to stay in the Navy, they were applying for that program, and some of them got it, and then they went through the application process, and then the rug was kind of pulled out from underneath them, and they went on and did different shore duties. I think SWOs sometimes, and I think obviously the retention bonus is a recruiting tool. You know, it's necessary, but I don't think it should be the first thing that we lead from in trying to maintain the culture of surface warfare officers. And I think everybody knows that. It just sometimes is expedient to emphasize kind of the different, you know, nice to haves, and the rewards, the good rewards for superior performers, during shore duty. But I think emphasizing as a community what sets us apart as surface warfare officers is leading at sea, commanding at sea. It's just a unique environment, and that's something to be proud of. And I think the patrol craft would be a way to emphasize that.
You know, Joseph, I'm glad to hear you say that, because it's some people, including myself on occasion, have fun talking about generations and stuff. But that's mostly just ribbing each other. There's continuity there through the generations. And that's always been a frustration for my co-host and I. We've talked about this with guests over the years that we're still trying to understand, is the series of incentives and disincentives that we offer our junior officers to stay in. And like you, and you'll be seeing this in spades here pretty soon, some of the best officers I served with got out and left active duty because they were frustrated, because they're being told things like, well, you need to go to shore duty. It's like, well, the the jobs you're offering to me, I will be doing nothing. You know, I want to go back to sea. And then I'll have people on the other side will tell me, well, people need to have shore duty. There's something that, like you talk about with the PC, if you told the type of lieutenant that you want to see for the next 15 or more years stay in the Navy, those that will raise their hand is like, yeah, I'll take that. If you can forward deploy me, that's great. Back-to-back sea duties, sign me up. I want to go do that. Whereas they can go someplace else and just have the soul sucked out of them. And there's something to be said about if you have your hand-raising lieutenants get command as a lieutenant, that when they become that XO or that CO down the road on your billion-dollar-plus warship, they've already learned some of those lessons and procedures early on, and it makes for a better Navy in that regard. And if for a second, you know, I wanted you to kind of extend that, what you're talking about before, is somebody who's, you know, just left a DDG and you're coming into a CG. And you talked about kind of one, and I'll use this phrase, you didn't use it, but a demotivator of getting rid of one of those few opportunities for a junior command. You know, what are those things that junior officers are hearing from Millington about what they, quote, need to do next that are demotivators to the type that you said you know from the Naval Academy you would like to see as your peers in 5 years or 10 years or so from now? And what are those things that would be great motivators for those people to stay in that are either gone away, non-existent, or are the high-demand, low-density type of positions?
That's a good question. I think it differs a lot from person to person, and so I think that's why it is good that there is a broad range of you know, shore duty assignments, because there are a lot of, I think the Naval Postgraduate School is a good motivator for keeping people in, and they develop intellectually there. It really differs from person to person. I think extended periods in the yards is a demotivator. I've been lucky to be able to go out on deployment and patrol both on Antietam and my last ship. And so getting out there doing the mission, I think if you were on a ship that had been in the yards the whole time, that's a demotivator. I think just seeing the logistics sometimes, just the lack of part support sometimes, as a demotivator. And then I think just time away from family. I think it's just being at sea, just the nature of the profession is very tough on the families if you have a family. And so finding ways for people to you know, have that protected leave periods is important.
Yeah, it's an interesting problem that, and I to harken back to what Sal just said. I mean, I remember talking to my detailer, and you know, you felt like they were always trying to force you into a template they had for what you ought to be doing. When all the interesting stuff, it seemed to me, was stuff that was unrelated to what their choices were, you know, and. That I will say that the best COs I had when I was on active duty were the guys who had prior command. Who, you know, one guy was had a minesweeper and then got a destroyer. One guy was a diesel boat submariner, ended up with deep draft ship. So, you know, that kind of experience made them they weren't as nervous as the first time COs that I had on active duty, and that I think that makes a big difference in how you get treated as a JO. I would, you know, when you're talking about having lieutenants have command, I'm hugely in favor of that. Lieutenant commanders, you know, if you had a squadron of small, fast patrol craft of some kind, and you had a lieutenant commander as their squadron CO, that would probably be a good job for him and help him move up, but you know, I'm not sure our system sees it that way. If you're a destroyer guy and you, Lord knows, you shouldn't then suddenly switch to amphibs because that would probably be a career killer. Do you view that template kind of concept that comes out of Buper sometimes as a negative?
Yeah, I'd say I've seen the same thing. Like, I had a CO in Lassen that came from a PC, and he was very good with, you know, ship handling and taught us a lot. And then now with on a cruiser, my CO has commanded a destroyer, and so he is very good with ship handling and is able to provide that mentorship. And my XO on Antietam also commanded a PC, and so I think that definitely is just something that is – I see it's just very beneficial in terms of getting those because it's just I think that's what one of the things the command at sea of a major combatant like a destroyer or cruiser is just such a huge responsibility that kind of tailoring these career paths to meet staff duty wicket. I know it's come out. I know the PERS thing is. You know, that from Buper's is that you have to meet these like four wickets of getting a master's degree, working in DC for 2 years, doing a joint tour, and then doing a Navy community tour. It's like that's what they tell you. That's what's being told in order for you to become with the ultimate goal of everybody becoming a 06 major commander. And so I think that emphasizing those things it just creates I think there's just a disconnect with the primary mission and motivation, job satisfaction of leading sailors at sea, and then just the being pulled in so many different directions to just meet let more shallow wickets.
Yeah, I don't feel like it's just you. That's, and I know you hear it even more than I do, but that's a constant refrain. And I don't know what it's going to take besides having a leadership who sees it that way to want to change, because in many ways that optimal career path that everybody's trying to be shoehorned, the amazing thing is it hasn't changed since I was a midshipman. It really, really hasn't. The advice is the same, but good gracious, the world is a lot different than it was when Ronald Reagan was inaugurated for the second time. But we still, for some reason, there's a lot of inertia, I presume. But I wanted to ask you earlier this, but so indulge me here. I want to back up a little bit. And this is one of my hobby horses, so I can see my co-host putting his head in the hand already. But we're talking about Holloway, Hayward, Lyons, late 70s. They had an opportunity with the better environment in the 80s to really push forward. Strong advocate, strong publication, big Navy story. I don't know whether you've had a chance to look at this or if this has been part of your reading or such, but all of that took place before Goldwater-Nichols Act of 1986. Where the Navy had the ability for its senior leaders to not go off the reservation, so to speak, but to really focus on what their job is, which is training, manning, and equipping a fleet that's ready to fight and win its nation's wars, etc. However, we have interesting things, and I won't mention his name. He's just had positional authority, but while you were deployed, I believe, there was a fascinating exchange between Representative Mike Gallagher, who is one of the strongest advocates for of the Navy we would like to see in Congress right now, with the Vice CNO. And the Vice CNO, every third word that he said was joint force, joint force, joint force. So I wonder if you had a chance to look at part of the challenge that we may have to make our argument is that our senior leaders exist under a structure that of jointness and the joint force that kind of puts them on report if they do overly advocate for a strong Navy.
Um, Yeah, that's a good question. I think that's one of the wickets is for the career path is that joint billet. I think that so I that was where I've run across Goldwater Nichols, but I think that's going to be a problem. I know that's something Secretary Lehman also talked about. He was on proceedings to discuss his essay on the 1980s buildup, and that was something he mentioned as well, is that he had that freedom to really, you know, pursue, put the resources where he needed to, just with the maritime domain being so global and just kind of breaking up within combatant commanders. That's a difficult question. I think that's definitely a difficult question, but you definitely get into positions where the combatant commander will want to, and this is another reason why we just need more depth in the force structure, but the combatant commander is going to want to minimize risk in his area of responsibility, and the way to minimize risk is to have concrete assets. And then on the other hand, the Navy has only a finite amount of resources, a finite amount of ships. And so I think that back and forth between the combatant commanders I've seen this in my career. That's a problem that will require a lot of thinking.
Yes, that's a great answer and a very difficult question. Look, your article is great. I think your historical background and your approach to what the Navy needs to do next, based on that history, is really, really important, really relevant. And I'm not sure all our questions today necessarily tracked along with the importance of what you were talking about. But it's been a great discussion. And I want to thank you again for being on our show. As we look ahead, have you got other plans to write another piece when you get the chance? I'm sure you're pretty busy right now, but are you looking at doing some more writing, or what's next for you?
I would like to write another essay at some point on integrating unmanned technology in the Navy, relating it to the broader force. I don't have anything, still doing some research in that, when I have time, but, right now it's just going through, the responsibilities of being the MPA on Antietam. That's my focus right now. So, I do hope to get around to writing again. I enjoy writing. I think it's important for naval officers to be able to express ideas and get that dialogue going to really kind of crystallize what we believe and the best way forward. And so I appreciate forums like you, and I think it's great that you and Commander Salamander have this forum, this podcast. I think there's a lot of great stuff that comes from that, and I think it comes back to the fleet, and it really provides a wealth of knowledge. And so at the moment, I don't have anything though immediately in the future.
Well, Joseph, first of all, thank you for the kind words. We really appreciate your time sticking your head out from the fleet, because I know being the MPA on a 35-year-old ship, that's varsity football right there. So you should be in pretty good shape. But when you do decide to write, you know, please pop me an email. You did a great job with this article, and I would encourage all the listeners, if you haven't already, on the show page, we have a link to it from Naval History Magazine. It's a great review of a period of time. Like I said, we went down a couple of rabbit holes, but there's a lot of intellectual effort that people need to make to that period of time as we all try to look at a way to build the fleet going forward. And again, Joseph, really appreciate you coming on here. Best wish for you and your sailors as we come into the holiday season.
Thanks again, Sal and Eagle One. Thanks for having me on.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. Until next time, we hope you have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Oh!